Session number 4693, Marjorie Grindley, Part 1.
A little bit about your background, Mrs. Grindley. Where were you born and brought up?
I was born in Luton, Chatham, and brought up in Gillingham afterwards. And from there, at the age of 5, I went to Hong Kong with my father in 1920-odd. Stayed for 3 years, came back again to the same house, and then went to school, secretarial college, job in a solicitor's, and then in 36 my father was transferred to Hong Kong again on promotion, and he made me go with him, mm-hmm. against my will.
What was your father's occupation?
He was a storehouseman in the dockyard, and his promotion was inspector of stores at Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, he couldn't pass that up for my sake, so I had to go.
Was the family fairly well off?
No, just ordinary, everyday family.
Mm-hmm. Now, you explained how you came to go to Hong Kong. How old were you at that time?
I was 18 when I went back the second time.
How did you feel about it?
Well, I was upset because I really didn't want to go, so nothing really didn't register very much.
Why were you upset?
Well, because I didn't want to leave my boyfriend. Of course, and I arrived with chicken pox, which wasn't very nice, so I was out of action for quite a while. Mm. And then somebody helped me get a job with an import-export firm. Then later on I got a better job with the government, and I stuck with that right the way through. Mm-hmm. Even after I was married, I was allowed to go back again.
You left England at the age of 18. One might have thought these days at the age of 18 you would have had a choice.
Ah, but in those days you didn't. When father put his foot down, that was it. Mm. I just didn't have any choice at all. I just had to go.
Once you had accepted the idea that you had to go to Hong Kong, what kind of expectations or anticipations did you have of life in Hong Kong?
Well, I didn't really know what to expect, but when we got there was tennis and dances and working, of course, so time passed quite pleasantly. And then when I met this Robert Grindley, things looked up then. He had a car, so we were able to go round mm-hmm. to the beaches. And
when did you actually arrive in Hong Kong?
January 36.
And where did you live?
First of all, we lived in a funny old flat with a central courtyard, and that was when I went down with the chicken pox. And from there we transferred to a rather nice flat in Gap Road, and that was a very nice flat. That was near the Happy Valley racecourse.
What sort of area was that in Gap Road?
Residential area. It looked onto Morrison Hill, where they were taking it down, and we used to watch the women cracking up the granite into small pieces for road making.
Mm-hmm. What sort of neighbours would you have had?
Oh, you didn't have any. We had all sorts of neighbours. There were Chinese, Europeans, all sorts.
So it was a racially mixed area?
Oh, definitely, yes, yes. But never any trouble. Never any trouble with neighbours as regards race or anything.
Yes. When you set up home in Hong Kong, could you afford a different kind of lifestyle?
Yes. My mother had a servant, an armour, and, a lifestyle was entirely different from in England.
In what kinds of ways? What were the main differences?
Well, shopping, for instance. I mean, you had to go to the dairy farm every day for your meat and your vegetables. Lane Crawford's for your bread. There was no deliveries. So a small comprador or grocer would deliver small things, but mostly you went and chose your own meat and what have you. And the lifestyle was, much higher than it was in England.
Can you give me any more examples of the sort of things you could afford in Hong Kong that you couldn't at home?
Well, you'd afford to go into a hotel for a coffee or an ice cream, which you wouldn't do in England. Things like that, all the little things that you could go in and get a length of dress material and not even think about it, whereas in England you'd have to sort of save up until you had the money to buy it.
You said you were living in a racially mixed area.
Yes.
Was there much mixing between the various
No, areas? None at all. No, each flat kept to itself. There was no mixing socially or anything like that. Our social life was the Dockyard Club. My father was secretary of that, and he was always a club man, so most nights we went down to the club and picked him up before we came home for dinner.
Why was there no mixing?
I don't think it occurred to anybody to mix. I mean, they had nothing in common, so just didn't mix.
What were the attitudes to mixing?
Oh, it was perfectly all right if you wanted to, but it just never happened.
Were there ever any cases where you might find a European with a Chinese girlfriend? Or
oh, yes. On the lower floor, eventually, one of the warders from Stanley Prison was courting a Chinese girl who lived in the bottom, in the basement flat.
What were the views of that?
Well, it was rather frowned upon in those days. They didn't like the idea of the men. Mostly it was the prisons and the police who married Chinese girls, and they didn't really like it. So that's why any new English girl that came to Hong Kong, she was top priority for for a wife.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were Chinese, Malays, Indians, Eurasians, as well as Europeans in Hong Kong. As far as the Europeans, the British were concerned, did they have different views as regards the different racial groups? Did they prefer some to others?
No, I don't think so, because you could only have Chinese servants. There were no others. No Indian or anything, or Malays. They weren't servants. There weren't very many Malays there anyway. It was mostly Chinese and Indians. Most of the Indians ran the shops, the dress shops, or the materials.
What were the opportunities for you as an 18-year-old as far as work was concerned? Were they good?
Oh, quite good. Quite good, yes. Oh, yes, they were very good. Especially if you had any qualifications at all as regards typewriting and shorthand. They were quite good.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody would wanted to get into the government service.
Now, for an 18-year-old single girl in Hong Kong at that time, what kind of life was it like?
Well, you went to work all day, and then weekends it was usually beach parties or dances. But my father would never allow me to go. Lots of the girls used to go on the naval ships, but my father would never allow me to go.
He'd been around sailors too long.
Exactly, exactly.
Mm. Were there any bad things about life in Hong Kong? Anything you really didn't like?
Oh, I don't think so, no. No, I was quite happy about it.
Thinking about the outbreak of war in 1939, what sort of impact did it have on Britons in Hong Kong?
I don't think anybody really realised that the war was on. As I told you, we went along the road and saw the soldiers either side of the road. We climbed to the top of the hill and saw all the ships, the merchant ships, leaving the harbour. And the next morning, the Japanese bombed Stanley.
Now I'm thinking about the outbreak of the European War.
Ah,
when you heard of
that,
the outbreak,
yes, that was very upsetting. Everybody was you just didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, we didn't know how the Chinese were going to react. You just didn't know, and that's all you can say. Well, the thing was that when France fell, everybody was absolutely down in the dumps. They just didn't know. That was the real bad thing about it. Because couldn't see any way that what was going to happen to Hong Kong. Not realising that the Japanese were on the way down.
Were there any local effects, local reactions in Hong Kong to either the outbreak of war in 39 or to the fall of France? Anything in particular that happened?
No, except, as I told you, then in the 1940 they decided to evacuate the women and children. I'm not certain whether that was anything to do with the European War or the Japanese War. I just don't know that.
What do you remember about that that evacuation? How was it organised?
That I couldn't tell you because I was at Stanley. I wasn't working at the time. And all I know, we were all called down to the clubhouse, and Major Wilcox, the Commissioner of Prisons, he was taking all details and saying that you will be ready, so and so, and they were all taken into Hong Kong, all the women and children. But in the meantime, I found out that if you had a job to go to and you had no children, you would be allowed to stay behind. So I went back to the Supreme Court and asked if there was a job I could have, and they said yes, and so I just didn't go to Manila.
I see. After the evacuation, there was a period when nothing really happened at all.
Nobody knew.
Were there any reactions from the wives and families?
Oh, yes, the wives in Australia, they didn't like it one little bit, because they said, why should we be living off the fat of the land, while they were sort of, I was going to say, pigging it in Manila and in Australia. Because they wanted to be with their husbands, and we were with our husbands, so that didn't go down very well either.
Mm. How did you, in Hong Kong, learn about the reactions of wives and family in Australia?
Well, the letters they wrote to their husbands. And some of the husbands weren't very happy either, but that was just one of those things. You couldn't do anything about it.
I mean, one would have thought that with the threat of war, they would be glad to have their families in a safe
position. Well, nothing happened, you see, in Hong Kong. The European war just seemed to have faded out. Nobody thought about that. It was just the immediate what was happening.
I imagine that a little later on, in December 1941, when the Japs actually declared war against Britain, that the atmosphere in Hong Kong must have changed.
That changed then, yes, yes. Then they were glad that they were out of it.
Yes. Tell me about that period. What was the sense in Hong Kong? What was the local reaction in Hong Kong after the outbreak of war, after the declaration of war by the Japanese?
By the Japanese. Well, I wasn't in Hong Kong. I was at Stanley then.
Right, what was the
You see,
reaction?
We didn't... Mm-hmm. Well, all we could just wonder what was going to happen. Because we didn't know anything. Nobody knew anything, because everybody thought the Japanese were going to come by sea, and they didn't. They came by land.
Now, although you were not in central Hong Kong, but at Stanley Point, you must have been involved... There must have been some preparations.
Oh, yes, we'd... Everything was laid on for the hospital to start, if things blew up, sort of thing, and we just sort of waited.
Yes. Apart from the hospital, which we'll talk about in a bit more detail, what other local reactions at Stanley were there, and what preparations against the possibility of a Japanese attack?
Well, nothing really. I mean, I don't know what happened inside the jail. I think they got rid of some of the prisoners with lesser sentences and kept the lifers there. But other than that, as regards... Oh, I think we did sandbag. They did sandbag the flats. And we had to black them out, and we painted all the windows with black paint. We had some people were evacuated from Hong Kong to Stanley. Odd people here and there. Apart from that.
Who did the sandbagging, and what was sandbagged?
The flats where we lived. I think they got the prisoners out because there was the beach. I think they took the sand from the beach and filled the sandbags and did it. The prisoners did it.
Now, there were some other preparations. I mean, you yourself were called up for
nursing.
Oh, yes.
Well, we would have
been... How did that happen?
I can't really remember that. It just that we were just told to report to Tweed Bay Hospital.
So you were sort of conscripted, as it were.
Yes, we were all... See, it was just the people that were living at Stanley who... There was four of us altogether who had taken this training, and we helped the Queen Mary sisters put up the beds and generally organise the... The jail doctor was in charge of the hospital as well. So it was all sort of local.
Did you have any choice about the things you might have done?
Oh, no. No choice at all. Mm-hmm. It was just a case of you, and that was it. Oh,
You had a month's training. Describe that.
It was a crash course. You did casualty, children's ward, surgical, and medical wards. And you had a week in the theatre. But you weren't, you were only, nowadays I'd call them an auxiliary nurse. You sort of took temperatures, washed faces, took food round, and generally cleaned up. Because they had Chinese armors and boys to do the actual cleaning. But we just, as I said, just did the washing and bed making.
I see. Now, Mr. Grindley was involved with the Hong Kong Defence Force.
Hong Kong Defence Force, yes.
How long had he been involved with that? What was the system of getting Britain?
Well, after the European War started, all the men were either the Hong Kong Naval Reserve or Hong Kong Defence Force. And then when the time came, they were all called up. My husband was actually in uniform and was stationed down in the clubhouse. He and, I think his name was Lieutenant Chatty. They were the only two left eventually in the clubhouse.
Presumably had some training and routine.
Yes,
duty.
Yes, they, same as the nurses, they had to go once a week for rifle, drill, and that was about all. As long as they could shoot straight, that was the main thing.
Did he get involved at any stage in the defence of Hong Kong?
Oh, yes. In the he was stationed in the clubhouse and was picking off the Japanese as they jumped across the road to try and get at the back of the clubhouse. They'd run down the road and then rush across the road and then they'd try and clip them as they went across the road. Mm-hmm.
Now, you've mentioned two things in which the Europeans were prepared for war. You with the nursing, your husband in the Hong Kong Defence Force. Were there any other areas in which the local British people...
Oh, ARP. But, of course, it just didn't have time to get organised. As far as I know, they were all in the Gloucester Hotel and the Hong Kong Hotel... under the arcades there. I don't think any of them ever really worked because it happened so suddenly that there was just no time. It was just out of chaos.
Can you give me any examples of the chaos, just to illustrate it?
Unfortunately, I wasn't there.
Any chaos at Stanley?
No, no, I will say there was no chaos at Stanley. Mm. I think we were all too frightened, if the truth were known.
One of the things that surprises me, or perhaps I haven't understood it properly, is that right up to the time of the Japanese attack, there didn't seem to be any great alarm in Hong Kong.
None at all, no.
Can you account for that?
I just, being British, I think, you just didn't show you were frightened. Mm. That's all I can account for. I mean, maybe the people at the top knew more than they were telling the rest of the people. But I don't think there was any panic. Because I know one of the officers at Stanley, at Victoria Prison, he was finally killed, but he was going out looking for Japanese. He was so... I think the majority of people were so angry. That was the general. You know, we're just angry at them.
At the Japanese?
At the Japanese, yes. And they just didn't care what they did.
Why were they so angry? Some incidences?
No, it was just that, you know, what are these people doing coming and upsetting us sort of thing? Let's have a go at them. And they did. And there weren't many left to tell the tale, I must admit.
Now, could you tell me again that little story of the shipping going out of Hong Kong? Because that was rather important as far as you were concerned in realising... perhaps for the first time that there was a war. It was the first real evidence for
it. It was the first evidence, but I can still say that we didn't realise that it was actual war.
Yes, but tell me that story. I mean, what were you doing?
We were just out enjoying ourselves. Mm. We went out. This fellow had a car. I think there were five or six of us. We all clambered in this car And I know he had a radio in the car, and the thing was in the mood. He was playing that, going along and banging on the dashboard. And as I say, we saw these soldiers coming down, filing down either side of the road. We waved to them, carried on. We decided to climb to the top of this hill. And when we got to the top, I thought, well, that's funny, what's happening down there? All the ships were going out of Lai Moon Pass. And we just could not understand what it was all about. And it wasn't until the next morning when they bombed Stanley that we knew what it was about. And that's as easy as that.
Mm. Lai Moon Pass. How do you spell Lai Moon?
L-Y-E-M-U-N.
Thanks. The following day, the attacks began, the air attacks by the Japanese. How frequent were they in the Stanley area?
Oh, not very frequent, not very frequent at all. They thought they were bombing the fort, which was at the top of the hill, and that was crowded with regular soldiers, and some of the defence force was up there. But that's what they made a mistake there. But then, of course, as they moved, they came via Taikoo, which was round the other side of the island, and got in the back way, and then they got to the waterworks, and the reservoir came via there, turned off the water, and then started machine gunning the flats. And that's when we really began to feel, well, something's gone wrong now. And then, as I say, in the hospital, when our own men started coming in wounded, soldiers coming in, throwing their ammunition away, then we realised that things were really bad.
Mm. Those bombing attacks, how much damage did they do?
Very little. They were very mean bombs, I was going to say. They had no explosive at all in them. It was just like a crump, and there was just a wee hole, and that was all. It didn't do any damage. Even their machine gun bullets, they machine gunned us, and you could watch the bullets coming by you. They had no power in them. Unless they came from a long way away, that's, and they sort of lost their velocity, I don't know, but we watched them coming by us. We were trying to get into the hospital. We decided to abandon the flats and all get into the hospital. We thought we'd be safe there.
Do you remember any particular one of those air attacks that stands out for any reason?
One attack, yes. I was in my own flat by myself, and they started shelling the flats, and I was really panic-stricken then. I really was.
What was it like?
Terrible. You just heard these crumps and you're all by yourself. And I just didn't know what to do. But as soon as it stopped, I ran over and joined the rest of the people. That's when we decided the best thing to do was to get into the hospital. So we all crowded in there.
How aware were you of what was going on in central Hong Kong?
The only thing we could see was the fires going. Could see huge clouds of black smoke all the way round over the hills, and we realised that, well, something very wrong was happening.
Any other evidence, like refugees from Hong Kong?
Only the soldiers. There was no civilian refugees. We found out afterwards that they had all congregated in the hotels, the Gloucester and the Hong Kong Hotel, which was right in mid Hong Kong, Victoria.
Now, when the Japs actually attacked, I gather from books that I've read that the fighting around Stanley Point was actually quite severe.
On the other side from the jail, it was. It was very severe. And it was all the young Canadians. You see, they had no experience at all. And the Japs just mowed them down. They didn't have a chance. Their equipment just didn't get into Hong Kong in time, so they had nothing. Just a rifle, and that was all. They didn't stand a chance.
What did you see yourself or learn of the fighting in the Stanley Point area?
Only from the people that came into the hospital, that things were pretty desperate, especially when they came in and started throwing their ammunition away. We thought, well, something's very wrong here. And then the Japanese were in the commissioner's house, overlooking the jail.
They started throwing their ammunition away? How do you mean?
The soldiers, because then they thought they would be taken. If they had no ammunition on them, they wouldn't be shot.
Did that prove to be the case?
As far as I was concerned, yes, because they didn't shoot anybody in the hospital. They did up at St. Stephen's College. That was a military hospital, and they bayoneted every patient in those beds that couldn't move, and two of the nurses. But we thought that what the that's the treatment we thought we were going to get, but we didn't, because we'd capitulated by then. So whether it's under the Red Cross treaty or not, they didn't take much notice of the Red Cross, I must admit. But anyway, we didn't. We were safe.
Mm-hmm. When Hong Kong surrendered in December 1941, and the Japanese actually occupied the Stanley Point area, do you have any particular memory of your first sight and first experience of the Japanese invaders?
It was when they came to collect the soldiers from the hospital, and all they were just like a lot of dogs barking.
Can you tell me in a little more detail about that scene? I'm sure it sticks in your mind quite.
Well, the lorries, they'd commandeered all sorts of lorries. They came up to the Tweed Bay, and they wanted all military personnel, regardless of whether they could walk or not.
How did they demand them?
Very, very, I can't think of the word, but let's say they were not nice people. They treated you like an animal.
Can you give me any examples that you remember?
No, they just shouted at people. And, of course, you just had to do as you were told. I'm not doing too well, am I? Sorry.
Let's concentrate a bit on the hospital work. You were called up for hospital work in December 41, just before the occupation. And you were telling me that Tweed Bay Hospital, where you worked, had originally been the quarters for the Indians who were employed in Stanley Jail.
That's correct, yes.
I guess it wasn't well suited to...
It wasn't well suited to a hospital at all. It wasn't even didn't even come up to a field hospital. There were iron bedsteads, red blankets, and a thin mattress. And that was the lot. The sisters from Queen Mary brought in supplies of sheets and pillowcases, but that was not sufficient for all the beds. So some of them just lay on a mattress and a blanket.
What else was involved in converting these married quarters?
We didn't convert the married quarters.
No, well, the Indian quarters were... These were staff quarters, weren't they?
For single Indian officers, yes.
Yes, what
it
else
was... dormitory style. Mm-hmm. That's how they were able to turn it into wards. And then, of course, they had to set up an operating theatre and set up the kitchens, because the kitchens were for cooking Indian food, not European food. That meant open chatties, open fires. So they had to contend with trying to cook rice on open fires. The policemen did the cooking in the hospital. They had squads who went down every day and cooked the food for the patients.